So the requirements for you are minimal because in this course they are minimal because you are doctoral students, and I realize that the most important thing for you is to build your research. That's the most important thing. One of my mentors, I would say practically, maybe not official, but practically one of my advisors, when he was doing his PhD, the only course he had officially in the books was boxing. That's what he's writing anyway in his memoirs. But I'm sure, knowing him, I'm sure that he was busy, that he went to many lectures. I'm quite sure about this. But he essentially selected lectures that he wanted to hear because they supported his interest and his work. And you should also think about it this way. You should learn as much as you can. This is the time of your life when you are learning, but you should select things yourself. There are some nuisance things, like you have to get this course also, you know, you have to get it. But I will have minimal requirements. The requirements are two, really. One is presence. I want you to be here. We have 10 meetings. I allow two absences, but they are absolute absences. I will never ask you for doctor's certificate. No, it's not my business why you are not here. If you want to say, that's fine, but I'm not interested. I'm not requiring you to say. So two absences, please, my advice, keep them for the times when you really need them. Like when you really have flu, or you know, you get called or something, that you cannot come. So try to be here. So 8 out of 10 meetings, I want you to be here. If something terrible happens, you know, you get into an accident, you go to hospital, just let me know, send me an email. We'll discuss it individually. Because that may happen, rarely, but may happen, of course. But generally, two absences and that's it. The second thing, as you see that in one of the next slides, is a short report of 5 pages towards the end of the semester. And the report should be as close as possible to your dissertation work. So actually, it's an opportunity for you to think about something in the context of your work. So otherwise, treat it in a relaxed way. Try to learn as much as you can. You can learn from everything, really, and the capacity of your brain is practically infinite, practically. So learn, listen with interest. If you disagree, if you have additional questions, just interrupt me. It's a seminar type of meeting. So lectures, I will be talking most of the time, but I would love it if we also talk about things, if we have discussions. Here is what we are going to talk about. So this is abusing a program that you will see later in the semester to show the connections between things. So the most important, the central thing in this whole course is this one. Learning the truth. That sounds very grandiose, right? Wouldn't it be nice to know the truth? Who killed John Kennedy? Why they killed him? Is there God? You know, these are all important questions. And there is some truth, right? There is God or there is none. There's no other possibility. Somebody killed John Kennedy and somebody ordered the killing, yes, too. So this sounds grandiose, but let's look at it in a more modest way. We want to learn the truth about the things that we are interested in. Each one of you is interested in something. You are doing some research work. In fact, I should ask you what you are doing, because that will be useful, I think. So what are you working on?
I'm working on hydraulic modeling and how different parameters affect the effectiveness of leakage detection using hydraulic modeling.
Oh, so you know Paweł Ostapkowicz?
No. Is he in...
He's in mechanical department.
No, I'm from the environmental engineering, so...
Oh, there's another place where this work is done. Mm-hmm. In fact, automatic leakage detection. I was involved in that research, so mm-hmm. very good.
Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many, like, ways to do it,
yes.
So I'm, like, in only, like, the small slice of this, but yes.
Of course. Who is your advisor?
Professor Izabela Bartkowska.
I don't know her. So. Mm-hmm. And what are you working on?
I am working on pneumatic brake systems in two ways, because I am using also the simulation methods and some kind of analytical methods, and I'm trying to compare them and in a way to determine the characteristic of a flow of the air through the elements of the braking valves. And I think it's all, yes.
So that's the mechanical department.
Yes.
Pneumatic, what was it?
Pneumatic brake system.
Brake systems, like in cars. They,
yes.
They also are pneumatic.
Yes.
Very good. And you're interested in... developing better systems or
yes, improving some existing I took a pneumatic brake valve and I'm trying to introduce some new section called differential section and I'm going to use also the software like ANSYS Fluent to determine the parameters of the flow using mm-hmm. this new solution, and also I built some kind of a test bench to also check the flow parameters of this new solution and compare both results.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. I think I get an idea. Very good engineering. And what are you working on?
I working with wood. I concentration to crack propagation in wood, and I try find cohesive to energy to crack length propagation. So. What happened when this wood start breaking in construction? So, mm-hmm. I don't know what.
I think I got the idea. Which department is it?
Because mechanical.
Mechanical. Okay, very good. When you have icons, iconic. Yeah. They reinforce the wood in the back precisely because of cracks, yes?
Yeah.
They make there's not a piece of wood in the other direction.
Yeah.
It's interesting, yeah. Very good. So, you know, when I say learning the truth, I mean learning the truth, whatever really interests you. So, in your case, it's, is there a leak or what kind of things are causing a leak or what kind of things are visible that are caused by the leak? That's a good question. The same in your other cases, in
pneumatic brake systems,
you would be interested in the parameters, how to make it better, which things are causing the brakes to be most effective.
Yes, and to build some kind of a simulation model with which no one to this time introduced, because the people used computational fluid dynamics software mm-hmm. to build some kind of other models, especially in kind of in some hydraulic systems, but no one tries to build some model when it comes to some pneumatic brake system. And also there are some elements. We have one piston which moves forward, then pressing on the other piston, then we are opening some flow channel, yes, in other the after some time we have some additional force which take our piston upwards and the channel are closing, the channel is closing and the additional channel opens then. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a some complicated and really time consuming.
The wood may be the most, the closest to the to natural systems. Although you are also interested in artifacts like skeleton of a house or roof, right? Things like that, where the cracks may be very important for the for the construction. So, in all three cases, you are interested in artificial systems that were built by humans. That's all right too. In this seminar, in the course, I will be often giving examples from natural systems. They are much harder than the engineering systems, because engineering systems, we build them, and we roughly know how they are working by the way they are constructed. But generally, learning the truth in natural systems is even harder than that. So we want to learn the truth. For example, we want to learn drinking red wine, does it help with the heart? They think yes, but we want to learn. Is it really true that having a glass of wine with dinner is a good idea? Yes. Now, the problem with learning the truth about the world is that the world is kind of not cooperating. It's often trying to hide things. So there are obstacles to learning the truth. For example, there are practical considerations. For example, I'd like to learn if there is life on the planets that were discovered in another around another star. You know that people have discovered actual planets somewhere, but they are too far. We cannot really easily determine is there life there. We would like to know, but there are practical considerations. We would have to send something there. That would take light years to get there. So practically, it's impossible. So we will not learn, at least not soon. There are also ethical considerations about learning the truth. As a child, another colleague told me that if you cut the chicken's head off, the chicken keep running. Right? I don't know if they ever conducted the experiment like this, but wouldn't it be interesting to know if people are also running? That would be also kind of interesting fun, but we will not do it because that would be very unethical. And people have done actually unethical experiments. They are famous unethical experiments, like experiments in concentration camps the Germans did. You know, they were doing a lot of terrible things. They were putting camp mates or prisoners in very cold temperatures to study the reaction of the body to very cold temperatures. Very useful for the pilots, German pilots, who were shot down over the English Channel. They were often in freezing weather, freezing water, and the doctors wanted to learn how to bring those people back to life or kind of resuscitate them. Very useful research. Ethical? Hell not, because very often those people died. But the Germans thought, well, you know, they're going to die anyway, I guess.
Were people according to them.
That's right, they were subhumans. And there were many other interesting research experiments done in concentration camps by Germans. For example, my wife told me, because she was working for a while on the problem of cervical cancer. You know, we know now that cervical cancer is caused by a virus. So it is a venereal disease. You spread the virus by the physical contact. The virus does some damage that over years can turn into cancer. We have vaccination against it. Germans were doing experiments on that, and there was an ethical problem after the war. Should we use the results of those experiments or not? They were obtained unethically, but should we use them? I think they did use them, the findings. There was an important experiment in the United States. They, in a base, military base, I think it's Tuskegee, whatever it is, it's probably somewhere southwest of the United States. They decided not to treat black soldiers, so Murzyni black soldiers, who had syphilis. They decided not to treat them. I don't know how long, but they wanted to observe the development of the disease. When that came out, it was, of course, a scandal, and it was one of the reasons why today you cannot conduct any experiments with humans or animals without a permission from the organization. So in our university, there's also a committee. I'm a member of it, but we've never met so far. So you see how many experiments there are with humans and animals in our university. So you need to describe your experiment and send this description to the committee. The committee decides whether this experiment is ethical or not. So today we cannot do those. There will be things that are interesting. You know, how else can you learn how to treat German soldiers than treating humans and resuscitating them? Very interesting, very useful experiment, but unethical. And it's something that disturbs us in finding the truth. Of course, for good reasons. I'm not criticizing it, but it's an obstacle. Another obstacle is our biases. We will talk about it. There will be one meeting where we talk about all kinds of things that are happening. So these two things. Biases are, you will see that our eyes and our ears are very imperfect. So even in your labs, when you do experiments, and you are doing a reading of a instrument, you have to be very watchful there. We'll talk about that. You have to be really aware of the fact that your eyes are imperfect, and also you have the tendency as a human to read, to see what you want to see. You see some examples of that. And there was an experiment, I think the mass of electron in physics. The guy was it Rutherford or one of those physicists, was trying to establish the mass of an electron. Realizing those biases, what he did is he decalibrated the instrument. So he moved the scale, and so every time he was reading a different measurement than he should have. And he did all the calculations with the biased numbers, so that he is not tempted to, to put things into it. And only at the very, very end, he did conversion of the final results. Very interesting. Very good, very good approach, because we cannot trust ourselves, our senses and also our biases. There's another thing, subject experimenter artifacts. In experiments, you will not have that in your experiments, because a piece of wood or a piece of liquid in the break will not interact with you, most likely. There's going to be no interaction. But there is a lot of interaction between experimenters and humans or animals. The concept of placebo. You give a patient a sugar pill and the patient gets better. Or, you start dancing around the patient. The patient heals, like, the shamans are doing. It's a real effect. So actually that dancing or that sugar pill helps, because in the mind of that patient, things are happening and he gets better. So we shouldn't be laughing at it completely, but we should be aware of it. When we are doing studies, like in medicine, we should know that the fact that we are giving a subject in an experiment a medicine, that already has an effect on that patient, whether this medicine is physically helping or not. There is another experiment with animals that is described by one of the authors of a very good textbook on these research methodologies. So the experiment goes as follows. And this is like a biology or medicine lab, and the students are in the room. There is a big labyrinth, so you know what labyrinth is, yes, the high walls. And the teacher comes in with a chest of rats, and says, your task is to teach the rats to find food in the labyrinth. So, you put the food in the middle, and then you teach the rats to find the food. And these are very special rats. We have bred them for the last 20 years. They are very smart in finding food. Another group of students, exactly the same thing, the same setup, the same room. He brings a chest of rats and says, your task is to teach the rats to find food. And these are just ordinary laboratory rats. Of course, you realize that they were the same type of rats, not exactly the same rats, but the same kind, yes, from the same genetically rats. They observed that the smart rats found the food like 70% faster. The time was 70% shorter. What could happen there? Maybe the students were pushing the stopwatches earlier with the smart rats. Maybe they were treating them better. You know, these are special rats, so you know, we treat them better. Whatever was happening, even between humans and animals, there is this interaction that makes the results of the experiments wrong. Again, you are lucky in engineering that these are artifacts, dead things, wood and metal and water. That will not happen, but we should be aware of that. Because you never know when you will be doing experiments with humans or animals. So this is the obstacles, this is the branch. We are going to spend one, I mean, not on ethical things, you know that already. Practical considerations, you can imagine them. Experiments in astronomy are difficult to conduct. Experiments in economy are also difficult to conduct, even though in communism, socialism and communism, they love to conduct experiments. But the question is it impractical or is it unethical? I don't know. Really. It's probably both. So just one class, we will talk about these more than the other ones. Things that are disturbing us in finding the truth. What is focusing on the truth? Well, many disciplines focus on the truth. Philosophy tries to, some branches of philosophy try to define what truth is. Religion is also about truth, right? It's the truth that is given to us. Truth, like every religion has dogmas, yes? These are the truth. And of course, it's very hard to for a person even who is skeptical to prove that this is or this is not the truth. So we are not going to focus on that truth. We are going to look at science. Science is kind of funny in that respect. It doesn't have any monopoly on the truth, remember. It just tries to avoid the things that it cannot say much about. So science tries to stay away from religion, and it should, because the religious truth is, I guess, very hard to test. It's not testable. Why is it not testable? Well, whatever thing I will say in religion, I can always explain something, saying God wanted it. So you cannot really test it. You have an experiment, whatever the result is, you say, well, God wanted it, yes? So it's essentially, at the very foundation, not testable in the scientific way. I'm not saying it's not true, but it's just not testable. So science requires things to be testable. Every truth in science is tentative, temporary. If we say, for example, that what would be a scientific truth? Smoking causes cancer. Right? I think people believe that these days in science. There's a lot of evidence for that. Suppose that there is suddenly an experiment showing that it's not cigarettes, but whatever, the paper that you have, that wouldn't work because pipes are different, right? Anyway, there could be an experiment negating it. There's a comedy, Sleeper. It's a comedy with Woody Allen, made by Woody Allen. I don't know if you saw it. It's very old. It's probably 1970s. A guy wakes up in 2500 or whatever, and he was a very kind of, like Woody Allen, he was playing the main character, kind of very frustrated, shy owner of a health food store who was put to sleep frozen in 20th century. He wakes up in 2500, everybody around him is smoking. He says, no, don't smoke, it's bad for her. And they say, no, science has discovered that smoking is the best thing that could be. Of course, it's a comedy, it's a joke, but in that sense, there are many things in science that were disproven. When I was a boy, I remember in 1970, I was a young man, maybe a teenager, I remember eggs were bad for you. because eggs contain cholesterol. Today we know that the cholesterol that you eat goes through your body. It's not dangerous at all. It's the cholesterol that you produce in the body. That's what I understand this is the today's state of knowledge. 19th century, people didn't know why some women got cervical cancer, some did not. But then they discovered, they made a very interesting observation, that nuns living in a monastery who were in celibacy almost never get cervical cancer. Well, some got, because maybe they had contact, intimate contact, before they became nuns. Right? Some may even they have other ways of contracting, I don't know, but they rarely got it, almost none. And prostitutes got a lot of cervical cancer. So then, you know, as a scientist, you observe an interesting phenomenon, a correlation. The question is, what is going on here? What is the truth? Yes? And truth can be tentative, because the moment you realize something, you can make the most beautiful theory crumble down into pieces. There's a beautiful quote that I have, I think, on our webpage. Science is not science fiction. It accepts the supremacy of facts over wishes and hopes. Even the most beautiful theory can be crumbled down into pieces by a simplest experiment. Yes? So this is the scientific approach. Science focuses on things that are testable, that can be falsified. That's the key. It comes from philosophy of science, early 20th century, that rejects everything that is not falsifiable, they call it. If you cannot, in principle, falsify something, then it's not science. That's what they say. So it's like religion. You cannot falsify it, because there's always an explanation, always. They said Marxism was not science. Why? Well, Marxism was saying everything in the history of humanity is class struggle. I remember that. I had to learn stuff like this in the 1970s. So you see, in the history, there was ancient Egypt. There was an uprising of farmers, fellahs, I think they call them, against the ruling class. What is it? Class struggle. You see a war somewhere or some revolution, class struggle. You see capitalists and workers, class struggle. Everything is class struggle. Everything can be explained like that. So this is not science, because no matter what you find strange, it's a class struggle, right? The same about Freud. They were saying that it's not science, it's religion. Freud would say, would explain everything as subconscious processes happening in the head. So you move your hand left, subconscious processes. You had a dream, subconscious processes, everything, right? So you cannot falsify the theory, because our behavior is governed by the subconscious processes. Therefore, you know, you can explain everything. So science is very interesting in that respect. How it works, how to do it, how to identify research problems. I used to teach that when I had more time, and there was no other class to teach it. But no, we are not going to talk about that. We are going to talk about science here and there, you know, mentioning the way it works, but kind of on the side. The most of the things in this course are these things here. When you try to learn the truth, you have hypotheses and theories. So, for example, I'm learning the correlation between... I'm noticing that nuns don't get cervical cancer and prostitutes get. Oh, I have hypothesis. Maybe it's the intercourse. So, you know, the fact that there is whatever, you know, friction or you know, contact between genitals, right? Mechanical contact. That's a hypothesis. But then, you know, I realized that observing, maybe having an experiment, no, that is not the case, right? Because married women who have intercourses also, if they don't have, and their husbands are faithful, and they are faithful, they don't get cervical cancer, right? So, what is it? Another hypothesis, something is brought over, you know, from the man to the woman, or vice versa, right? And you know, you're looking for it. So hypotheses are things that are essentially guesses. You are guessing. This is the case. In your context, of course, you may be guessing. The humidity is the important thing for the cracks. It's a guess, right? You start measuring humidity, and if you exclude that, you have the hypothesis, you have shown that it's not true. Theories are bigger statements. They already have empirical support. There are all the facts, experiments, that are consistent with the theory. And most of them should be consistent with the theory. There may be some things in the theory that are not completely right. Yes, but if they are minor, then we are willing to say, well, the theory is still holding, but we don't have any better. The theory of evolution, I don't know if you knew that there are a lot of things that cannot be explained by the theory. Well, not a lot, but there are things that cannot be explained there. Still, it's probably the best theory that we have, right? Still. Physics, we still use Newtonian physics, Newton's theory of gravitation, forces, accelerations. It's a good approximation. We know it's a false theory. We know it. Theory of relativity, we know it's false. There are actually experiments proving it's false. It's still a useful approximation. A quantum theory, I don't think there are experiments showing it's false. It doesn't make much sense, the theory, but still it's probably the best theory we have. We suspect it's false. Why do we suspect it's false? Because every single theory in physics was proven false at some point. The probability that we got to the truth is not very high, actually. There's probably still something going on at the lower levels or whatever. So theories and hypotheses. Now, in order to disprove, theories are not proven. Hypotheses are not proven. They are disproven. That's an interesting thing. It's a philosophical outlook. The fact that you find something consistent with the theory cannot prove it. In philosophy of science, and don't be scared of the word philosophy, as scientists you should have a little bit of philosophy, but one branch of philosophy especially. It's not the philosophy like, theology or philosophy of the nature of things, where they discuss for hours whether a brick is a concrete thing or not. That's the joke that Richard Feynman did once in a philosophy meeting. They were discussing about things that were, is this concrete or not? So at some point he brought a brick and said, is this brick concrete or not? And he writes that the discussion started again all over whether a brick is a concrete thing. So that's not the philosophy I'm recommending you, even though it may be interesting. Philosophy of science is a branch of philosophy that where people, the word philosophy, it's love of wisdom. Philo, Sophia. Sophia is wisdom in Greek. Philosophy of science is focusing on the scientific methodology. So when you are studying the wood and the cracks, you are using methodologies, you are using an experimental setup, probably a very established one. But the moment a new methodology appears in the world, you can be sure that there will be some philosophers of science who want to look at it carefully. Mm-hmm. Are the conclusions drawn from the experiments in principle correct? That's what philosophy of science is doing. So in philosophy of science, there are two fundamental problems that are unsolvable. And when I present them to you, you will see that they are unsolvable. The first problem is the problem of determination. The problem is essentially the following. The thing that I see there on the wall is white, yes, and blue. How on earth do I know that it's white and blue? What are the grounds on which I'm declaring them white and blue? Well, these are some experiences in my eyes, my senses. You are probably seeing white and blue too. But there are examples of where some people see blue, some people see yellow. Or whatever. I'll show you some pictures of that. So the question is essentially, this is a funny example, but the question is, how do we know that the world that we are learning, that we are seeing, using our senses, eyes, ears, taste, touch, how do we know that our senses are not lying to us? In what sense are they objective? It's an unsolvable problem. You know, our senses are essentially limited. So of course we are seeing things, we are sharing that, we agree on things, but in principle there is some border where we cannot go any further because of the limitations of our senses. Not a terribly big problem, but we need to realize it. The second problem, even easier to understand, is the problem of induction. The problem, the example that they usually give here is the following. Suppose you have seen 9,999 black ravens, kruti, czarne kruti. Can you say all ravens are black? Can you say that? You can't, because you haven't seen everything. Yes? I can say in this room, probably, I mean, if I did some extra examination, that all of us are male, right? Sometimes, you know, the looks may be misleading, but, you know, if I examine, I can say, oh, we are males, adult human males, we are men, right? I could say that, but in general, if you want to make statements about the world, it's harder, because I haven't seen all the instances. So that's the problem of induction. The problem of induction prevents us from proving a hypothesis. Proving a hypothesis, proving a theory. How? Well, I have a hypothesis, and I've seen many good instances, still I haven't seen everything, yes? So I cannot prove a hypothesis, but I can easily disprove it, yes? I take off my pants and I show you that I don't have a penis, I have a vagina, right? I'm disproving the hypothesis that all of us are males, right? Something like this. You see a white raven, not true that all ravens are black. So my hypothesis goes down. So that's why we are disproving and not proving. An interesting view, right? So we can disprove something but not prove it. And this is where where this falsifiability comes from. You cannot prove a hypothesis, but you can falsify it. You can show that it's not true. For that, you just need one instance to prove, well, it's not true, because I see a counterexample. So science focuses on those things that can be disproven, falsified in principle. So empirical work, so, you know, looking at the world, testing it, tasting, smelling, you know, in essentially observing the world, that's in empirical work. Empirical, so it's, you know, the doświadczalne, empiryczne, manualne, dotykamy. Some people say that Middle Ages was this dark age where people were stupid. That's, of course, complete garbage, this statement. Middle Ages produced a lot of wonderful things. But there was one problem with Middle Ages that we understand now. People were focusing on different things. They were focusing on things like religion, you know, praising God, art, not on the empirical things. They were discussing, you know, I don't know if it's true because it's so stupid. They say that they were discussing how many legs a fly has without actually catching a fly and counting, right? I don't think this is true. This is too stupid. People were not stupid. I don't believe that. People will think about us. Some stupid people 1,000 years from now will think about us as stupid. They are stupid, of course, because I don't think we are stupid. You know, we have limited knowledge. We don't know everything, but we are not stupid. I don't think people in Middle Ages were stupid. They just didn't realize how important it is to just look and measure and, you know, test something instead of making statements about things. So empirical work, it's something new in the history of humanity. That's the last, whatever, 200-300 years when people started to focus on, well, let's measure, let's look, let's see. That has caused a lot of excellent developments, the development in science, in engineering. Each one of you is doing now measuring, right? Describing, and measuring, comparing to the world. People in Middle Ages were not focusing on that, essentially. So this is the empirical work, very important these days. And then hypothesis testing, we are going to talk about it today and next week a little. Some history I will mention as anecdotal things, not in a systematic way. Analyzing data, that's statistics, of course, as a tool, just a tool. Then in experiments, we have experimental method. And this is also something, not everything has been said there. So we cannot say that we know everything here. There are many experimental designs, so we do experimentation. There are many types of experimental designs, and there may be new designs discovered later. Even these days, in the last 20, 30, 40 years, new experimental methods were proposed and accepted also. So this is there is no reason to think that we know everything. But in this course, I will tell you about what we know. So the experimental designs, how people, what we know about studying reality by experiments, architectures of experiments. So you can observe, like you observe that nuns are not getting cervical cancer, but prostitutes are. That's an observation, interesting thing. We observe that smokers are getting cancer, that cancer patients, more of them are smokers than in the population. These are observations. In some disciplines, of scientific disciplines, observation is the only thing that you can do. What are these disciplines? Astronomy. We observe. How can we do the experiments? Well, maybe some observational experiments. I think some of the experiments that are that were proving theory of relativity to be wrong were observations during, let's say, an eclipse. I think this was the experiments. Eclipse, zaćmienie. You could use that as an experiment, as if you were manipulating, right? As if you were manipulating the moon to cover the sun. In a way, it's an experiment, right? You compare that situation to a situation when there's nothing between us and the sun. I think there, with the eclipses, I think they were doing the experiments with disproving Einstein. But they were observations, essentially. History, a good scientific discipline, mostly observations, right? What about anthropology? Right? Sociology, you can do experiments already. Right? You can manipulate things. But so there are disciplines where you can only observe. But there are disciplines where you can manipulate. Manipulation is another synonym is intervention. You intervene, you change something in order to observe the effect. And that's a wonderful thing. If you see the development of a child, you will notice that children are intuitively doing experiments. You must have observed, if not your children, then children of your friends, your siblings. A child goes to a switch on the wall and starts turning it on and off. Parents get upset because it starts flashing. What the child is doing, it's doing repetition, trying to see if it's indeed a rule that when I turn the switch, the light goes on. Right? It's a good scientific experiment, intervention. I'm intervening, seeing something happening. They will forbid the child to do it, but the child will still try to. The child will experiment. The child comes to your house, a child of your friends. The first thing the child will do is to be very shy. But then the child will typically start pushing the boundaries and seeing how far can I go being bad before they do something about it. Right? These are all experiments. And I think we have it in us. And these experiments, as a goal, have learning the world and especially learning the causal nature of the world. So the causal structure, what causes what? It's a fundamental thing. Understanding, true understanding is causal understanding. So observing that nuns are getting not getting cervical cancer, but prostitutes are, that's just an observation. It's not enough to do something. If I'm a woman and I want to avoid cervical cancer, what do I do? Become a nun? Not enough information, really. You observe correlation. Yellow fingers are correlated very highly with lung cancer. So what? If I wear gloves, I'm intervening. Wearing a glove, I will not get cancer. Of course, you know, it's a common cause. People who smoke hold cigarettes in their fingers. The fingers get a little yellow. But that's just because there is a common cause causing both cancer and fingers. If we don't understand that, merely correlation is not enough to decide what to do. Yes? The reason why, I hope you are not smoking, the reason why you are not smoking is probably you want to be healthier, you want to live longer. The reason why you are not eating hamburgers all the time, drinking Coca-Cola, is you also want to be healthier. This is all scientific knowledge. We know that a lot of sugar and a lot of fat is not good for us, right? Many things like that. You know, fundamentally, you are working on your doctorate because you know that this hard work will cause finishing your PhD and then getting doctorate and then going, following up on it. Causal knowledge, very, very important part of understanding. That's why the experiments, most of the time, they are focusing on establishing, is there a causal connection? That's the kind of the fundamental experiment, intervention. I'm intervening, and that causes a change in the system. I'm making the environment more humid and observing the behavior of the wood and comparing it to the behavior of the wood when the humidity is normal or dry. Yes. The same with the water leaks and with pneumatic. When you change the components of the liquid, right? You see, it's stronger or weaker. Then you can, in case of engineering system, it's actually very easy. You know that it's the liquid that makes the difference for the strength of the braking, not the other way. It's because it's an easier system to study. You know the engineering of it. The same in your case, you know, the fact that you are observing some water around the pipes, right? You know that it's a leak. The water doesn't come in, it goes out, right? So it's an easier problem, but generally in the world, it's harder. When we observe, you know, we observe that people who drink some wine, Mediterranean diet, we observe that they have less heart disease. What is it? Is it olive oil? Is it wine? Is it pasta? Right, we start observing. Causal knowledge will help us. If we learn that it's wine, oh, we start drinking wine, right? And we know, I mean, if we know that this is the truth, that this will have an effect on our health. If we know it's olive oil, we eat olive oil, right? So anyway, different approaches to experiments, experimentation, this is the classical. It's more in most disciplines. I'm trying to get the pointer. We have experimentation. We have different designs, architectures that were proposed, developed by people. We will talk about experimental, factorial, and quasi-experimental designs. That will take us two meetings talking about this. We will not talk about this. This is a modern technique developed in 1960s, 1970s. Accepted in cognitive psychology, but also in artificial intelligence. People in psychology are studying things that have impact on artificial intelligence methods, process tracing, having people solve problems and then talking aloud, essentially. That gives us information about how they were thinking. Survey questionnaires, you know it, the typical one, a survey. Who will you be voting for in the next election? Don't say nothing. I don't want to put you on the spot, but that's a survey, right? You essentially pick people, a representative sample, and ask them who will be, you voting for. And in the second, what is it called? Druga tura. Second, I don't know it, what to do it in English. Second round of elections, let's say, right? That's a survey. In survey, you can ask about people's experiences with certain. One way of testing your brakes is, of course, measuring. But once you install them in the car, it's a different environment. Maybe the things that you were measuring are not reflecting the actual usefulness of those brakes. So what you can do is you can produce 20 cars with your new liquid, new brakes, new construction. You let them ride. Of course, you measure accidents and things like that. Maybe you can measure the length of braking. But you can also have a survey asking them at the end, what did you think about the brakes? How do you compare them to the regular brakes that you were using in your BMW? Yes, you can test that. And that's a survey. That's a good scientific method. Of course, it's not as exact, as powerful as measuring with a good instrument. But that also gives you an idea, because sometimes people's experiences may give you useful information. So that's a survey. We are not going to talk about it. Maybe in the context of choice of subjects for the survey. And modeling and simulation, very useful methodology, very modern, has a history, but in science it started being used in 1990s. Essentially agent-based simulations. I don't know if you've heard that concept. We will talk about it one meeting towards the end. Essentially you can simulate groups of people, societies, by means of software agents. You can have a computer program where you have 10,000 agents simulating people. And you can simulate, you can see how disease spreads, or how people migrate, or how people conduct wars, how people evacuate a building. You construct essentially a small aquarium where you observe things, you run the simulation and draw conclusions about a society or a population of animals or, anyway, living beings, agents. A good scientific method that is very modern. Causal discovery, 1980s, 1990s. These days making really big steps into science. We are going to talk about that partly because I know that field quite well. I've worked in that field. So you see that these methods are very powerful. They may become useful for you in analyzing data. So it may become useful. I've seen actually your colleagues earlier apply these methods in data analysis. So just wait. So that's pretty much the content of the course. I think I've covered everything. So if you just kind of see it. Learning the truth in the scientific sense, of course. Can you ever learn the truth in the scientific sense? Regretfully not. Truth is always tentative. We may reject it. We realize that we didn't have the right grasp on things. It's just because the world is difficult to study, with many obstacles, many difficulties. You cannot prove anything. You can also falsify things. So you can get close to the truth. You can get asymptotically close to the truth, but you will never get there. Depressing, isn't it? If you want to know the absolute truth, if you want to have that, you have it in religion. People are by nature religious. You know, they have the need for this stability. But science will not give you that. You have to get it from other things. Religion, not philosophy, I suspect, philosophy just steers things up, but doesn't really give a good solution. But religion is a good thing, where the truth is absolute. Not in science, though. This is what we are going to talk about. It's exceptional that today's slides are in Polish, but the rest are going to be in English. So we will start with statistics. Probably not today. If we do, then we will not spend a lot of time. Definitely we need to talk a little bit about statistics to give it a proper place. Statistics is not magic. It's just a tool to help us analyze the data that we collect in experiments. That's it. Help to make us a decision. A decision whether we reject the hypothesis or we keep it. We still keep it because maybe we'll reject it next time, right? But reject or not. And then there are a causality and probability, very important thing that is going to become important in causal discovery, discovery from data. Then two classes on the architectures of experiments, a class on problems in the laboratory, so the obstacles I was talking about, a causal discovery, and then simulation, artificial societies. That's pretty much the content of the meetings of the lecture. I'm going to try to give you as much intuition as I can. You know, the anecdotes I tell on the site have the goal to give you the intuition. You will never forget, you will never remember anything unless you understand it. And whenever I tell anecdotes, things around it, it's to help you to understand something. And if you understand it, you will remember it for a long time. And the idea is that you should grab useful things out of the material and remember them. Those that you don't remember, you will not use a pity. Right? Of course, it would be good to remember everything, but that's impractical. So remember the most important things that you find puzzling, interesting, and I'm going to try to convince you that there's a lot of common sense and logic in science. So why do I say that? Why do I want you to know that? So that you are not intimidated by science. Very often we feel intimidated, you know, the statistical methodology. Am I using the right hypothesis testing tool? Am I setting up the experiment correctly? I want you to feel this, the knowledge that humanity has accumulated, so that you feel reasonably comfortable, that you are not getting intimidated. If somebody starts criticizing your experiments, that you know what to say. And you can be sure that every experiment, every result can be criticized. You will see that in the architectures. Everything can be criticized. You should, when you present your results in papers, in conferences, you should feel comfortable with what you have done. And hopefully that intuition will be strong enough for you to feel that way. There will be a Kama Sutra. You know what Kama Sutra is, right? It's the Indian book outlining all kinds of sexual positions. It's kind of a funny thing, right? So all those experimental designs are going to be like, you know, different positions. But this is not as important as common sense. Because you will see when we talk about the different experimental designs, why, what are their weaknesses, what are their strengths. And it's important to remember. There is, I think, like umpteen, less than 20 different designs, and but the most commonly used is a handful. And each of them has some problems. Statistics is just a tool. That's another thing that you should get out of this. The goal is to have an overview of all these methods of studying the world, help you to think about the empirical part of your dissertation. Every dissertation that you have will have to have an empirical part. You know it. When you say a statement, it's the humidity, you'd better show an experiment that you conducted, right? That you rejected. You rejected the temperature, etc. You show. So that's an empirical part. In case of the brakes, you have to show in an experiment that your new wonderful mixture of liquids absolutely leads to the biggest strength of your hydraulic brake. And in your case, you should show what observations are the most indicative to detecting the leak, right? For example. So there will be definite empirical part. Why? Because we are doing science. And science that is armchair, like, you know, you sit here and, no, I think that the world works this way. That's worthless, of course. There is an anecdote. You will see that in most of the experiments, you need a population of subjects. You need a sample. One of my advisors, Herb Simon, had papers, a few papers, handful of papers, where there was only one subject. He was studying a human who was doing solving a problem, giving verbal protocols that were analyzed. So once I actually asked him, Herb, or Dr. Simon, I used to say Dr. Simon, even though he would always say Herb, but coming from our culture, you know, a much older person with a Nobel Prize, I'm not going to call him Herb. So often I will say Dr. Simon. How could you get away with one subject in your experiments? Get away is to, jak to uszło na sucho panu, tylko z jednym podmiotem tego eksperymentu. And he said, well, it depends who is asking. A biologist asking, oh no, no, biologists would not ask that, because they often do experiments with one subject. They have their favorite chimpanzee, a monkey, that they know very well, and they essentially observe that monkey, and they can make statements about it. No, biologists will not ask that. But if economist is asking, then I would say one subject is better than no subjects. you have to see it in the context of him. He got a Nobel Prize in economics for a theory of bounded rationality completely grounded in observations. The theory says that humans are not maximizers. Economy, the foundations of economics is that humans are maximizing their utility. Utility is a function essentially of preferences. They're maximizing their preferences. And firms are maximizing their profits. Fundamental foundation of economics, assumption. So if you have a company, you try to make money. If you are a human, you maximize your preferences. You like sweet things, you will eat a lot of sweet things, yes? Your behavior, consumer behavior, what you buy, essentially maximizes your satisfaction. So then I don't know if he gave that example or I invented that too, but I don't know if any of you is married already. Married, you are not. That's all right, nothing wrong with me. I think optimal age for a man is 30-something, but nothing wrong with being married earlier or later. Anyway, you know, you should wait for a partner who you really want to share the rest of your life with. Anyway, when you think about how you chose your wife, look, if you were maximizers of utility, the world has, when you were, well, now, the world has 8 million people. Billion, right? Billion, which is milliard in Polish. 8 billion people, half of that are women, 4 billion. Well, many of them are children. Let's say out of 4 billion, 1 billion are children. Out of 8 billion, 1 billion are elderly women. And, you know, there's 1.5 billion of the remaining women are married already. You are not going to marry a married woman again. That's not possible. So there's probably, I don't know, 300 million people in the world, women in the world, you could marry, right? If you were to maximize your utility, you should think about the criteria. I don't know, the beauty, wisdom, a good heart, intelligence, whatever, you know, there's a set of criteria. Can she cook well? Can she quarrel, right? I mean, can she get out of a quarrel? All important criteria for marriage. If you were to maximize your utility, you should study each one of those 300 million women and pick one that maximizes your utility. Right? Can you do it? Impossible. I'm going to be 68 this year. If I were to do that and, you know, study all the women available, I would still be busy and I would have probably studied, I don't know, 500 women. Maybe 300, right? So impossible. We are, we cannot do it because of our limited capacity. We don't have the computational power for that. So he said essentially the foundations of economics are good for the birds, not for people, essentially. They are empirically just wrong. He got Nobel Prize for a theory of bounded rationality, that people don't optimize, they satisfies. It's a new word he invented, satisfies. They essentially pick the first alternative that looks reasonable, good enough. Maybe not the first, but, you know, among the limited alternatives that you have seen, your heart was pounding stronger with one, and then you said, oh, okay, this is the woman I want to be with. This is the way I acted anyway. I suspect many men act this way. So when economist is asking, I would say, well, one subject is better than no subject, he said. Interesting. So remember that the game is not to be to fulfill those abstract requirements that you have 20 subjects at least, 20 repetitions of your break, of your pieces of wood. Sure, very often, if you can afford it, if you can do it, that's a very strong thing. But the game is to prove, to show logically that that hypothesis is wrong, right, or falsified. Or show, I wasn't able to falsify. That hypothesis is probably correct, yes? So that's the logic in it. So you have to think about your dissertation. That's one of the things that will happen, hopefully. Another thing is you will become better consumers of scientific results. When you look at results, you read in a newspaper or a magazine or you see on TV something, you will probably be more critical. You will be a more critical consumer knowing what can go wrong. You ask yourself the question, how do they know, actually? What did they do, right? And when you read the paper, you will read critically. You will ask yourself, what was the experimental setup? Is there another explanation of the results? That other explanation is called, by the way, rival hypothesis. Hypothesis that also explains the results, but they haven't thought about this, right? And so this is what you should get out of this these 10 meetings. I told you about this. Be here and also write a report. If you send me 2 pages, I will also accept that. It's not graded, but it's really a way of asking you to think about your dissertation and how will you approach the empirical part of it. And I think you are already advanced enough to think about this. So it's an opportunity for you to think and get my feedback. I'll give you feedback on that. If you give me 2 pages, I will accept it too, but if I were you, I would spend some time describing the problem so that I understand it, and then describe what you want to do. The more details you put, the better for you. But don't make it really long. 5 pages is enough, really. Because otherwise, I'm going to get lost. So, writing short is actually harder than writing long, if you want to write it well. Okay, material. I'll send you an email, maybe, with the links, so that you don't have to search for them. I'll put all the slides there, and everything that is useful for you to know. Recordings also. Any questions? We still have a few minutes. Instead of finishing early, I mean, we could always do it, but I don't like finishing early. I'll use my time always. We can start with something, and maybe we will stop at a place where there is where you have to think about something as you go home. I think I have the material, the slides somewhere else. Actually, this is just fine. I think I have it here also. Actually, I don't care. I don't think I have anything there. Okay, so a review of statistics. We are getting into this treatment of uncertainty. I'm going to get to a few slides only. I'm going to finish at 7:10. Here is the plan. So it's really about statistics and why we want to use statistics in studying the world. First of all, the very important thing that if you haven't realized it, you should, that the world is full of uncertainty. So whatever you are looking at, there's a lot of uncertainty. Uncertainty is the result of our ignorance, or we are either ignoring something, we're ignorant, or we decide to approximate. For example, if I flip a coin, probably if I knew the exact speed with which I, the force I used, the exact angular speed, the particles of air, I could predict, it will fall on the table, maybe the which is, what is it in English, I forgot.
Bounce,
maybe, of the table, I could predict what side the coin will fall in, right? But it's so difficult to model all of it that I say, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to describe the coin by probability of falling heads is 50%, tails 50%. Sometimes it's difficult to describe, like in your case, the wood has structure. Every piece of wood is different, right?
Yeah.
And very impractical to actually describe it. So maybe you will say, okay, I'm deciding that I'm describing the wood as a parameter, some parameter with noise, right? The noise is essentially, it's uncertain what piece of wood you will get, what the properties are going to be. You describe it using probability theory, statistics. In any case, nothing in this world is certain, according to Franklin, except for death. We are all going to die. And taxes, somebody will tax us. Of course, he was joking about this, but he wanted to say that everything is uncertain. If we are dealing with uncertainty, then if we are dealing with anything, a good idea to look at mathematics. You go to do shopping, you should look at arithmetics, adding, multiplying, subtracting, because if you don't do that, they will cheat you on the money, yes? 2 + 2 = 4 and not 5. Mathematics. The same with uncertainty. The branch of mathematics that is dealing with uncertainty is probability theory. There are proofs that if you violate probability theory axioms, you are going to lose, for sure. Just like if you think 2 + 2 = 5 and are willing to act, I'm going to pump all the money out of you. If you believe that, I'll give you two coins of 2 zloty, give me 5. Right? It's the same. Until you have no money. The same with probability. If you violate any of the axioms, you can prove that you are going to lose on that. That's a joke. Our statistician will drop in and explain why you have nothing to worry about. When you look at data, and data are, when you conduct experiments, each one of you will be writing down your measurements and observations, right? No way around it. This is a typical data set. Of course, it's universal, very understood. You see columns and you see rows. Columns are variables that you are measuring. Rows are the values for an instance. So every piece of wood, every break that you are studying, every piece of your water piping is just a record, a line that you measure, or an instance. Maybe you measure it over time. And so here is, we have people. We measured sex, smoking status, and whether they have lung cancer, and then age. And then on the left hand side, we have the number of the record number. So one thing that you can see here is that it's a mess. The real world is a mess. We have a smoker who is 81, the record number 5, who didn't get cancer. And we have a non-smoker, second record, who has cancer, even though she's a non-smoker. So this is not atypical. When you observe something, you will see noise. You will see less of it in engineering applications, because you will just see some noise, a little bit. Some small differences in the liquid mixture, some wood structure that you didn't account for. But you will always see the noise. And the noise, there are many reasons for seeing the noise. Bad luck, subject selection, etc. I'm going to stop on this example, but there are just a handful of slides, 2 or 3 slides on this example. You can think about this. So I took it from a paper that's a psychologist explaining causality, how we establish that there is a causal relation, wrote the following. Suppose we are ignorant about the causes of pregnancy. We don't know what causes pregnancy. But we suspect, we have a suspicion that maybe sexual intercourse has something to do with pregnancy. So when you have sex, you can become pregnant. But we don't know it. Imagine that we don't know it. So we want to conduct an experiment. It's one of the designs that we are going to talk about. It's actually quite a good advanced design. We find 200 couples, a man and a woman, say they are married, they're married couples, and we randomly, you will see why randomly later, we randomly allocate them to one of the two groups, intercourse group, where we tell the couples, from today on, you should have intercourse at least once a day, preferably a few times a day, if you can. The other group, we say, please abstain from intercourse. Don't have sexual contact for a month now. We have two groups. We tell them, okay, go home. When you come back, we'll pay you for the experiment. Very often we pay money to subjects for the experiment. Then a few properties of the experiment that we are going to talk about in details. We want to make an inference about all people, all humans, and we are selecting a small sample only. Right? We select a sample, and based on what we see in the sample, we infer about the population. Each one of you has that. You don't study all the wood in the world, but just a few samples. The same with the, right? You do that. Sample. Of course, sampling should be good. You take typical, you sample randomly, etc., make it representative. If the sample is not random, the results are going to be potentially wrong. If I don't take a random sample, but I assign all the women with long hair to one group and all the women with short hair to another, or all women above 50 to one group and another, there may be a problem. Sampling not random, I go to get my subjects in old people's home. The results are going to be biased, yes? There is no guarantee, but usually if you do it correctly using statistical approach, you can get arbitrarily close to the properties of the population. This is the way the data will look like. Every couple has one record. And of course, we have a couple for the pregnancy, for the intercourse group, for the treatment and control group, different couples. And this is going to be the last slide for you to think about. This is what we are getting. In the intercourse group, where people were supposed to have many intercourses. By the way, we don't have 100. This is a problem called in research design mortality. It doesn't mean that they died, that four couples died during the experiment. They dropped off. They said, no, we don't want to do it anymore. And you have to allow for it. In your experiments, one of the breaks can break. You had 10 breaks in your study, one of them broke. Sorry, no, I have 9 now, right? In your experiment, some of the wood, something happened, right? Or the pipes. That's mortality. So you will not have the 100-100 typically. And that is also a problem. We will talk about the consequences of that. But please note, treatment, 20 pregnancies, celibacy, 5. Oh boy. Our first reaction is, the experiment failed, right? So, and this is not atypical. Maybe in engineering experiments, you'll get cleaner data. You will get 85 in the treatment. You get just 1 or 2 in the control. But you can be sure that you will get something like this. You will not always get an effect, no matter how you control it. In this case, we understand what is happening, so we can talk about the causes of why is there difference and what to do with it. Next week, we are going to talk about what to do with it. As a scientist, you have to do something about it. They are knocking on your door. The people who gave you money for it, or people who are the journalists, are asking you, what are the results? Thank you very much. Sorry, I think I extended by a minute. I'll see you next week.